The suspected gunman who killed 22 people in El Paso wrote online that he was afraid of, quote, a Hispanic invasion of Texas that would push out white Americans. Angry young white men have been responsible for many of the most recent mass shootings in our country. Our next guest has personal experience with white supremacists. He actually was one decades ago. His job now, working as an interventionist of sorts by traveling the country and the world in an attempt to get those mostly men out of hate groups and off of message boards spewing hate. Christian Piccellini is founder of the Free Radicals Project. His upcoming book is called Breaking Hate, Confronting the New Culture of Extremism. Christian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with the shootings. So I want to know, what was the first thought that crossed your mind when you heard the motives of the shooter in El Paso, that he was afraid of an Hispanic invasion in Texas?
Well, I was first horrified, like the rest of the world was, upon hearing it. But I have to say I wasn't surprised that it happened. The rhetoric that I'm hearing today in our society is very similar to the rhetoric that I used to say 30 years ago that was part of our white supremacist neo-Nazi movement. Everything from the words invasion to, you know, the idea that people are going to replace whites. Those are all ideas that I used to spout when I was a neo-Nazi in the 80s and 90s.
Let's talk about you for a moment. You describe your parents as Italian immigrants who were open people, accepting of diversity. What led you to become a neo-Nazi?
Yeah, and that's true. I came from, you know, a loving family that I knew cared about me a lot. But because they were immigrants, they also had to work extremely hard. And they were gone 7 days a week, sometimes 14 or 16 hours a day, just trying to make ends meet. So I grew up really without my parents around, and I felt very abandoned by them, even though I was surrounded by love. So I went searching for a sense of family elsewhere and also a sense of identity and purpose.
You were recruited when you were 14 years old. It was 1987. And as you said, you were searching for a sense of identity. It was a sense of family. What was it like for you being a part of this neo-Nazi group? And what else was it for you?
Well, it absolutely provided camaraderie that I hadn't found in real life until the age of 14 years old. I grew up fairly alienated and bullied. It empowered me at first. It was the first group of people that accepted me as a family, that filled me with a sense of purpose. And 14 is a really magical age when it comes to extremism or radicalization. And that's, you know, for far-right groups, or whether it's ISIS or even gangs in inner cities. It's the time when young people are really trying to develop that sense of identity, community, and purpose. They're breaking away from their parents for the first time. And if young people are feeling marginalized, or maybe they're vulnerable, and they get detoured by what I call potholes, the things in life that we encounter, things like trauma or mental health issues or poverty or joblessness or even privilege, which can keep us in a bubble. Those types of things detour people as they're searching for identity, community, and purpose. And on the fringes, there is always somebody with a narrative ready to give it to you and certainly blame somebody else for the pain that you're feeling.
I want to talk a little bit more about how you got out of it. And it's important to talk about this because it's important to say the reason why we're having this discussion is not to make the shooters victims at all, but to really get a deeper understanding of the psychology and what fuels someone who is filled with such hate to kill people.
Right.
So I want to talk a little bit about how you got out of it. I read that you once owned a record store and a black teenager came in. You guys got to talking about his mother who was suffering from cancer. And that was the first time that you had actually seen black people as human beings?
Yeah, it was, you know, really the first time I had a meaningful interaction with the people that I thought I hated. I opened this record store to sell racist music that I was making and importing. And what I didn't expect to happen was that people would come into my store to buy the other music that I was selling. And you know, those people were black and Jewish and gay. And suddenly I was faced with this humanization that was replacing that challenge. And I bonded with that black teenager because my own mother had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was something that we shared aside from everything else that, you know, was filling my head.
Are you suggesting that simply knowing people of color will help angry white men and boys be less racist?
I would certainly never put the burden on people of color to make that happen, nor would I, you know, encourage people who are traditionally victims of racist violence to make that leap. But I can tell you that receiving compassion from the people that we least deserve it from at times, maybe when we least deserve it, is often the most powerful thing. In fact, it might be the only thing I've ever seen truly break hate to overcome that demonization.
Every time there are tragedies like these mass shootings by a racist person, the focus always turns to gun control. I've heard from you in the past say that people with bad intentions will just use other means, bombs, for instance. I want to know what the answer is from your view.
Well, I think we're failing young people. You know, radicalization does not start when somebody finds an ideology. I think that the pre-radicalization stage starts the day we're born, when we start to hit those potholes in the road. And if we can't fill them, we get detoured to very dangerous kind of fringe areas. And I think that we are failing young people in the sense that we are not serving their needs. We're not amplifying their passions. We're not finding the areas to refocus their energy before they find these ideologies. Nobody is born racist. And while, you know, we certainly see the results, the monstrous results of the things that these racists do, you know, in my work, I have to believe that at some point that person was pure and, you know, maybe couldn't find their way. That's my job, to see the child and not the monster, because I have to believe that there are other people like me that, you know, were intercepted at times when they were vulnerable and ultimately could find the right path.
You're doing this work, but how many folks are out there doing this work?
You know, there aren't very many people doing it. And I think that part of the barrier is that most people think that they can't do this work. There needs to be an infrastructure of psychologists, of job trainers, of life coaches, mental health professionals, and mentors who can take over the aftercare with these people, people from their communities who can interface with them one-on-one. I'm a bridge builder, but I certainly, you know, can build that bridge, but I can't build the road after that. That's up to people and the people in their communities to really step in and help. But one of the problems with this is that there has been no focus on far-right extremism in our country ever. And in recent times, any effort to try and analyze the problem has been defunded. And it's very difficult to be able to do this work without being able to train other people to help them understand what some of the strategies can be to do this intervention work with people who are at risk of violent extremism.
After the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, President Trump famously said that there were very fine people on both sides. You talk about at some point we were all pure, but he got a lot of criticism for saying that. You've also said you see good people who are also white supremacists. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, I had an issue as well, as most people do, with what President Trump said when he said there were very fine people on both sides. But there may be people there that it was their first time meeting another white nationalist, that maybe the experience wasn't what they expected. And in fact, I've had many people who attended the Charlottesville rally reach out to me afterwards because they wanted to not be associated with that. It wasn't something that they felt they believed anymore, or at least they were questioning what they believed because of what happened. Now, there were absolutely people there who were intending to cause violence, to cause mayhem, and certainly they're accountable for their actions. But in my work, trying to ensure that people don't go further down that route, I have to provide escape routes for people who are, you know, intentioned on changing and not just trying to skirt the issue.
And what are some of those escape routes?
Well, you know, I do a lot of listening, and I listen for those potholes, and I try and introduce them to the people that they think that they hate, because oftentimes they haven't had those interactions where somebody, you know, goes into a room thinking that they hate somebody else and walking out knowing that they have so much more in common with that person than they have different. It's a very compelling moment to witness.
I think back to your parents, who you say were good people by all accounts, and I'm wondering what they could have done, what other white parents can do to either de-radicalize their children or stop them from going in that direction in the first place. What will you tell them?
That's a really great question. And, you know, people tend to think that what I do is very specialized. And certainly because I am a former extremist, I have, you know, a certain credibility talking with people who are still extremists. But I think all parents, all psychologists, all teachers can do what I do. And that really is just identifying vulnerable young people and then amplifying their passions, trying to fill those voids in their life. Because I've never met a happy white supremacist. I've never met one with positive self-esteem. Everybody in these movements are there because they are broken to a certain degree and they're looking to project their pain onto somebody else. And I just see my job as kind of a bridge builder to the services that they need. And that's not making excuses for them. I still hold people accountable in many of the same ways I've held myself accountable for 23 years.
Christian Piccolini is founder of the Free Radicals Project. His upcoming book is Breaking Hate, Confronting the New Culture of Extremism. Thank you for joining us, Christian.
Thank you so much.